Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Now, we're talking tonight about dissociative identity disorders. Now, these are a range of conditions that can cause physical and psychological problems. Some dissociative disorders are very short-lived, perhaps following a traumatic life event, and resolve on their own over a matter of weeks or months. Others can last much longer. Now, as I was saying earlier on, this is something that's very new to me and not something I'm familiar with. It can affect anyone from all age groups and racial, ethnic and socioeconomic backgrounds. They can all experience a dissociative disorder. And I'm joined by a great friend of ours here at Black Country Radio and, of course, Friday Night Clive from Dudley Mines, Sandra Vaughan.
Hello, Clive.
Hello, Sandra. Thanks ever so much for joining me. As I said, I've always said in life, don't pretend you know something if you don't. Say you don't and then you learn. So tell me, first of all, what is dissociative identity disorder? Seems such a mouthful, really.
It does, actually, and I thought you gave quite a good explanation, to be honest, Clive. I thought it was probably time for me to go and leave it to
no,
you.
No,
I mean, it is a mental illness, and it causes a breakdown, sometimes in perceptions. So it can cause amnesia, where the person is almost taken over by what they call an alter. So almost an alter ego.
Oh, right, okay.
I wouldn't like to suggest that it's anything like the Jekyll and Hyde situation, but sometimes the individual may not be aware that somebody else has taken control.
Okay, I'm with you so far. Is this the same, though, as multiple personality disorder?
It used to be called multiple personality disorder.
Ah, right, okay.
I mean, I think the problem with this type of condition, and when it was called multiple personality disorder, is that people often start to talk about split personalities, when actually, obviously, it's a slightly different thing.
So what will trigger this?
I mean, you're spot on, trauma. In about 85% of all instances of this condition, then there's been some history, some long history of abuse. But as you said, a traumatic experience, so an accident. If you think about people who were subjected to the tsunami, some of the Grenfell Tower fire, you know, even the Twin Towers, people who might have survived or been exposed to that, that can trigger. But that's the same for a lot of mental health conditions. Trauma plays a big part. Also, which we say in mental health, that if a child loses a parent under the age of 11 and that bereavement isn't supported, then that can cause major problems later on in life. Because obviously it hasn't been dealt with.
Sure.
But it's the same for this.
So I guess you could say that post-traumatic stress disorder could trigger this, or is that something completely worlds apart?
Well, no, I think in a way it could all be interlinked, post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, I mean, that could, and acute stress disorder, you know, a slightly lesser-known condition that doesn't last as long. That's quite short-lived, but that could trigger something as well. I mean, the mind's very complex, and we don't really know what actually triggers sometimes these things. It's an unknown quantity, but certainly PTSD and some other conditions could. I mean, a lot of things often relate into trauma following an operation. If somebody feels that they're going to die, they've developed post-traumatic stress disorder, but that can be from a physical illness. So if somebody's had an aneurysm and they thought they were, you know, they could die from it, that can trigger certain things as well.
So if let's say I work in an office, for the sake of argument, and I'm sitting next to somebody who is experiencing this, how would I know? What would be the symptoms that I would need to look out for?
I mean, I think that is the problem because, I mean, a person with this condition normally has their own personality and then there's usually one or more other personalities, what they call the alters. And I think it is slightly difficult to identify because If we think about personalities, we all adopt a bit different personality depending where we are. So somebody could be one type of personality in the office, but you could go out on a social evening and they could be completely different.
That's true of a lot of us, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
We go into work mode and then out on the town, we're completely different. And, you know, for those of us that are in this industry, when I'm on radio or I'm on television, I'm in professional, you know, delivery mode kind of thing. But, you know, all I've got to do is sniff the cork of a bottle of wine and I'm anybody. So you see a completely different side. So
exactly.
Is that what you're alluding to?
And then that in a way is like, you know, really, I mean, we're not talking about personality disorder as such. I mean, it's a different thing. Mm. But we all adopt so many different personalities. You know, if you're on holiday, Clive, I'm sure you're completely different.
Yeah.
And it's the situation. And in work, we may dress up or dress down, consider, you know, to suit the occasion.
Yes.
So we adopt that different persona.
But as for identifying symptoms, then, that's not the easiest thing to do.
I don't think it's very easy to diagnose, even, to be honest, because of that. Because if you think about it, psychiatrists are relying on what they see or what they hear or what the individual actually tells them.
So let's look at, for example, some associated conditions that might help us identify if somebody's experiencing that. What could they be, for example?
Well, like any mental illness, then there are associated other conditions such as depression, anxiety that might go with it. And if you think about somebody who might already be diagnosed with this, and they might be unaware of when almost they're taken over by another personality or another alter, that can be really frightening. And that could lead them into depression and even a suicidal risk, because they feel they're not in control. And often a lot of mental health conditions people don't have control over.
So how do you go about diagnosing this then? If you're a professional, if you're a psychiatrist or even a GP, what do you do?
I think in a way it's what I said, it's what you're told and
right.
what you see.
You just have to rely on that person
and probably
being open
and
honest.
What other people might say. But of course with confidentiality and data protection, it's difficult sometimes to get that information. I mean, I guess in extreme cases, the individual might come to the notice of the authorities because of their behaviour out in the community. So they might come to the attention of the police or in a supermarket, or the GP might start to identify that there's something not quite right. Because often something, when the alter takes over, the individual might not remember what's happened, so it's a bit of amnesia. In some cases, they might remember some of it, and that can be quite distressing.
So it's important then for emergency services people to actually, you know, think a little bit deeper into this and consider this as an option if somebody is showing what they perceive to be is abnormal behaviour.
It is, but if we talk about abnormal behaviour, that's often how we identify a mental health problem.
Yeah.
Because people are acting out of their ordinary behaviour. So I think it's very difficult. I mean, with this condition, then there's a very few instances of it. So, you know, it's not one of the major types of conditions. And I think, really, it's not talked about a lot because of that.
Does Mind offer courses to the emergency services people that relate to this and actually cover this subject?
Not specifically. I mean, we do offer what's called the blue light training, which is specific training for blue light services. And I suppose touch on that. I mean, an organisation that are very good at this is an organisation called PODS. And I've got a website address for you.
Okay, so what does PODS stand for?
PODS stands for Positive Outcomes for Dissociative Survivors.
Positive Outcomes
for Dissociative Survivors.
Advising.
And the website is www.pods-online.org.uk. And there's a lady who works for PODS, Caroline Spring. She's written quite a few books around dissociative conditions and has experienced that herself. So there's a lot of good training courses they put on that if somebody wants to know more.
What treatments are available?
A lot of there's no specific medication to treat that at the moment. But obviously if somebody's experiencing depression or anxiety, then they can have medication for that. So we're looking again at therapies, so psychotherapies. There's one called EDMR, which is to do with eye reflexes, which is used a lot with PTSD and trauma, where when the individual's recounting what's happened to them, they actually keep moving their eyes from left to right. It's quite successful, but nobody actually knows why particularly. But there's very little treatment around, and I guess that probably you'd have a job to find somebody who could deliver. There's also another type of psychotherapy where the individual actually talks about their relationships and their life, mm-hmm. and the therapist tries to piece together where the trauma fits in and where their condition has come from. I mean, I think this type of condition like PTSD probably takes long-term intervention. I mean, as you said, sometimes if it's a single incident that's caused it, some course like confusion, then perhaps, yeah, they would recover reasonably quickly. But like a lot of things, I guess that obviously if the individual doesn't realise it's happening, then it's difficult for them to seek support. If they do, it can be really frightening and scary, and they can think they're going mad.
Because I suppose they feel then that they're not necessarily in control of their own mind.
Yeah.
Which is probably quite frightening, particularly if that person is vulnerable in the first place.
And I think society as a whole frowns on behaviour that's out of the norm, so they could be quite discriminated against because of their behaviour.
That's something that gets my goat, really, because you see people who have a preconceived idea about somebody's behavioural traits, and they're very quick to criticise and to chide. And actually, you need to think a little bit deeper that, that person could have, a mental illness of some sort that's underlying. A lot of it is invisible, as you've already said. And I've said to you before, I have depression, but if you saw me ordinarily, you wouldn't have any clue. But it's something that I have. And I mean, okay, that's a different matter. I get that. But it must be difficult, really, to deal with and to process.
And I think, there can potentially be misdiagnosis. I think one of the things that could be misdiagnosed as schizophrenia, it could be misdiagnosed, could be as dementia.
What's schizophrenia then?
Oh, briefly. Schizophrenia comes under the umbrella of psychosis.
Right.
So schizophrenia and bipolar disorder come under the umbrella of psychosis. Schizophrenia is diagnosed by three positive symptoms: hallucinations, delusions and thought disorder.
Ah, right, okay, understand.
So things like hearing voices, firm beliefs that aren't true that you can't shake. And people with schizophrenia are often accused of having a split personality. But the split actually relates more to not being able to distinguish between what's real and what isn't real.
I'm with you. Okay. So going back to dissociative identity disorder, can it go away without treatment?
Well, as you said, it might only be short term, but it can escalate. And I mean, I guess it depends how many other types of personality. I mean, if somebody's had several things happen to them, then there can be four sort of five areas in their brain that might take over, or one might not understand the other.
Sure.
Really interesting.
On the balance of probability then, who is more likely to be diagnosed, males or females?
Well, it's the usual old chestnut, it's us females.
Really?
Again. Yes. There are very few conditions actually that males outweigh us on. But it's more likely to be females.
And is that just down to the makeup of the female body, I guess, or is it anything to do with, something that females do that's different from males,
well,
for example?
It could be all sorts of things, but generally, I mean, we're back to the situation where females are more likely to go and talk about what's going
on. It's the old stigma. Us chaps, we're rubbish at it. We really are, So what should people do if they're worried about somebody who thinks they may have this? What's the best thing to do?
I mean, there is support for in carers groups, but not specifically for this sort of diagnosis, this sort of condition. So initially, I mean, the way is through the GP. Trying to persuade the individual to go to the GP or to talk about what's going on. But if it's a family member, you know, if it's a pet, if it's a child or a teenager, then a family member, parent might be able to talk to the GP or get some more information. But I guess that most GPs will not have come across this. I don't want to be unfair to GPs, but GPs' field is not mental health. A lot do are very good, and they do gatekeep the way into a lot of services. But, you know, you can't expect them to know everything about mental health as well as physical health.
No, that's right. But so really what you're saying is that the GP is the first sort of starting block then?
Yeah. Or local mental health team, you could contact directly the local mental health team. Or you could contact through social services and see what's available. Sure. I mean, I don't know of anything in the Dudley Borough that's available. Mm. And certainly in most areas, council, it waits for counselling. You know, long waits.
Long waits, yeah. Well, do you know, I've learned something because, you know, you hear about different kinds of mental health disorders, if to use that phrase. But I genuinely had never heard of this. But I can see because, as you say, it's difficult sometimes to diagnose. I can see why it kind of gets swept into, you know, as you say, anxiety, depression, anything else that's similar, really. But there we go. Well, as I say, I like learning things, and that's the beauty of Friday Night Clive. You never know what you're going to find out about next. So
you'll have to come on one of our two-day mental health first aid courses, Clive.
Yes, I would be interested, actually. Yeah? I'd be interested. Brilliant. Sandra Vaughan, thank you very much, as always, for talking to Friday Night Clive.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest instalment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. Now, if you're a parent or you have other responsibility for a child, how do you know that what they see on the internet is safe and appropriate for them? Now, you cannot look over their shoulder all the time, can you? Let's be honest, in reality, that doesn't happen. Although some supervision is always good. But if something goes wrong, what can you do as a responsible adult? I'm joined on the line by Stuart Favill, who is a supervisor from the charity Childline. Stuart, thank you very much for talking to me.
You're welcome.
Why is technology and the internet so popular with children?
It's in the world. It's there for children to see and use. Everybody's interacting now on the web, adults and children alike. Mm. And it isn't all bad, far from it, because there's lots of amazing things for children to discover and use on the internet. And it's a tool that's with us for the foreseeable future, I think, as a race of beings now. We've created the World Wide Web. And there are so many things out there that young people and children can interact with and learn from. But as well as it having all these positive forces, there are also some rather negative ones as well that we as adults need to be aware of. And our kids have probably grown up with the internet and the web and computers at school. I mean, when they threw me out of school, I just got used to abacuses. So it's been a learning curve
absolutely
for me as well.
What would you say to any parents or responsible adults where they don't allow their children to access the internet at all? I think that's a bit harsh, but what do you think?
I think it's a bit harsh as well, because it's there, but it's having the right amount of controls and supervision on understanding yourself as an adult as to what your kids are seeing and doing online and who they're interacting with.
And of course, the internet,
like any other tool, it's got its dangers.
Sure, but the internet isn't all bad, though, is it?
Far from it. I mean, there's some fantastic things that we can learn from using the internet and interacting with other people. I mean, I've been talking to a relative this evening via social media who lives in America.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, I would probably have had to ring them up, which would have cost me an absolute fortune.
Quite.
So, you know, there's positives and there's negatives.
We hear a lot about online abuse, though. What constitutes online abuse? Is there a way that you can define that for me?
Oh, there's many forms of online abuse. I mean, things that you've got to look out for, things like cyberbullying. Now, young people and children can be bullied 24/7 because it used to happen at school, and when they went home, the bullies weren't in their home. But now if they're online, they can be bullied online. So that's a thing that can happen around the clock. They can be emotionally abused by people online. It's very easy for young people to start talking to people who they don't know anything about, mm-hmm. and aren't who they're saying they are. So young people could get groomed online, and they could get persuaded into doing things like sexting, and then
what's
all
that?
Kinds of things like sex. Sexting is sending pictures of themselves that are of them in the nude.
Right, okay.
And
I don't get why somebody would want to do that, if I'm honest with
you. No, but this is what happens on the web. And we get lots of calls from young people who are really distraught because they've been coerced into doing this by somebody who isn't all who they seem.
Mm.
And then they can be blackmailed by, if you don't do this and you don't do that, we're going to post this online and everybody's going to see it. Our advice to children and young people would be never, ever, ever send anything to anybody that you don't want the world to know.
True.
Once it's out there, it's out there.
Are there any signs that a child has been victim of online abuse, or what kind of things should you look out for?
Oh, there are things that you can watch out for as a parent, and the signs that something's going on untoward with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because as parents, we should know our kids better than anybody else. And the things that we might be noticing would be they might be spending a lot more time or a lot less time using social media. So it's a change in patterns of behaviour.
So, yeah, it is just behavioural trends that
yeah,
that change.
Yeah, they could all of a sudden seem withdrawn, upset or outraged, mm-hmm. when they've been, you know, using the computers.
Or suddenly,
or they start being secretive about who they're talking to and not talking to you about what they're doing. Because we think it's very important that as parents, we have that dialogue with our kids about what they're doing, who they're talking to.
I suppose another behavioural trend as well would be if a child who is, you know, a habitual internet user for whatever reason, all of a sudden not using it.
That's right, yeah.
You know, that's something else to consider.
And it could be quite a quick change. Or they could have lots of new phone numbers or texts or email messages coming into them from all over the place as well.
So how can we keep our children safe on the internet then, Stuart?
It's talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to be as aware as we can as to what they're doing and who they're doing it with. So it's having some parental control. And that has to be there, because if we're not careful, things happen. There was an article in the Metro, because I travel to work on the bus mm-hmm. every day
mm-hmm.
From Wolverhampton to Birmingham. So at 6:15 in the morning, I was on the bus. And I read an article about a couple who'd got an 8-year-old daughter who they'd got an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And they put all the controls on it that they thought could regulate it. But she'd managed to circumnavigate all those and activate it by a fingerprint. And had ran up a £2,000 bill on the gaming site.
Oh, crumbs.
And that was in the paper this morning. And that's an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
So just imagine what your 15, 16-year-olds could be getting up who are very, very computer savvy, but they might not have the emotional intelligence to deal with what they're getting into on the web.
Sure. I think you're right. I think a lot of it has to start with parents, and parents have to be parents rather than friends, and in the sense that they have to be quite vigilant. And, you know, it's for their children's own good. Now, we've talked a lot about how parents and responsible adults can do their part. What more would you like to see internet service providers do?
Well, the NSPCC have been campaigning quite a long while now for a bit more regulation and control by the people that provide these services. And through the campaign we've been running called the Wild West Web, we've been at the forefront of this campaign calling for more independent regulation of social networks, because an awful lot of people are making an awful lot of money out of this, and they should be putting some of that into making sure that our children and young people are kept safe online.
Tell me about the Online Harms Reduction Regulator Bill, which is a bit of a mouthful, but what effect will that have, and what is it really?
Right, the bill's requiring Ofcom to prepare itself to become like an interim online harms regulator, and that role would look at them setting up a kind of a blueprint for placing a statutory duty of care on techie companies that will have to protect children online. And like NSPCC, Childline has been campaigning for this to happen now since 2017, so this is an ongoing thing that we've been campaigning quite hard for, really. And this will mean that they'll have to publish a report that recommends that there's going to be kind of like a duty on online platforms to ensure that the people that are using those platforms actually are protected in law.
How difficult is it, though, where somebody commits an offence online by, as you say, appearing to a child or young person as someone who they're not? And let's say that child talks to their grown-up and say, you know, this has happened, look at this kind of thing. It's difficult, really, to actually, through the authorities and through legislation, to trace that back to the offender who could be on the other side of the world, conceivably.
Absolutely, but the police do have the capacity to trace things. So if you've experienced something untoward online, don't delete it, keep it, and report it to the police. You can report it either to CEOP or to a website called Think You Know, which is run by the police.
Mm-hmm.
And child exploitation people in the police, they can actually look at tracing where these people are from.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always possible, because some people come through on the dark web and hide their tracks very carefully, but we've had a number of young people that have contacted us and have taken the matters to the police and had successful things happen.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, clearly the process works. You know, which is encouraging. I think there's still a lot more that can be done, as you've alluded to. Well, tell me more about what the NSPCC is doing to raise awareness of online abuse of children.
Well, we've got the new campaign that we've been running that started on the 20th of April. And people can go onto our websites and look at this. There's a phone number that we're running with O2 and the NSPCC Online Safety Helpline, and I can give you the number for that if
you want.
Yes,
please.
Yeah, it's a free number, so it's 0800 800 5002.
Okay, 0800 800 5002. Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the website address?
There's also the website, which is the NetAware website.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just do a Google search for NetAware, which is NETAWARE, and there's lots of advice there on how to have conversations with your children about online safety, and maybe what to discuss, and how to set up maybe parental controls, and looking at how you can support your children to get the positive things that we can get out of using the web, rather than getting sucked into all the negative and harmful stuff, which is there just as easily to access.
I suppose it's also reasonable and not uncommon to actually contact your service provider and say, you know, guide me through your system. How can I change my settings or do whatever? And as you say, put checks and balances in place to safeguard users.
But be aware that kids can circumnavigate that, like that little girl on the paper today. And it's encouraging your children to be open and honest with you, and you being open and honest with them, because there are dangers out there, and it's being aware of it.
Yes. And again, I think, as you said, it's down to adults being more vigilant. You know, this does start in the home. I'm not excusing the bad behaviour of people who use the internet inappropriately. And as I said earlier on, it's not realistic for a parent to be looking over their child's shoulder all the time. But I think parents have not, you know, have got to not be scared about, you know, what are you looking at now kind of thing, or show me this, show me that, just so they can understand, because, you know, children are not going to learn, are they, unless they're guided by their parents.
And this technology is out there. It's changing all the time, and it will continue to evolve and change. And we need to try and keep up with it as much as we can as adults, even if it gives us a headache sometimes.
I'm sure.
Getting in touch with the current youth culture and what kids are talking about. But we need to be aware of what our children are doing.
Absolutely. What a fascinating subject. I've learned quite a bit in about 15, 20 minutes. Stuart Favill from Childline, thank you very much for talking to Friday Night Clive.
You're welcome, Clive. Thank you for having us.
What a fascinating subject. There's things there that I never knew that you could do. But I think Stuart's quite right in what he says, in that, you know, a lot of it starts with parental control and parents being interested and looking at what children and young people are doing. Now, as Stuart said, there's the website called NetAware. If you just put that into a search engine, that will come up with some details there. And there's also the online safety part, which you can, if you've got any queries or you need to report something, then you can give them a ring on 0800 800 50 02. That's 0800 800 50 02. And if something does go wrong, then you can ring the police. Again, as Stuart said, simply because they do have they certainly got the powers, but they have the capacity and the technology to actually start and trace people back, even if they're on the other side of the world. What concerned me before I even started that interview, while we were researching this, you hear so many people who are the victims of some form of online abuse, and they seem not to be able to trace the offenders back. But as Stuart explained, that can be done now with the advances of telephony and internet service providers. So, you know, it is possible. So if you do have any concerns, always ring the police and let them deal with it. Never take matters into your own hands. That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.